My name is Roy Malloy, and you are listening to The Dawn of Crime, a podcast dedicated to the faces and the places and the people who have made this sketchy country as amazing as it is through its criminal activities, dubious undertakings, and sketchy, shady dealings. I'm going to be joined today by a good friend of mine and a prolific repeat offending comedian, a gentleman who I met in one of the vaudeville theatres that my partner and I own, the Apollo Theatre in Melbourne, a stand-up comedian who came to us, made people laugh, and did that's kind of the bare essential. That's the guts of what a good stand-up comedian should be. I'd like to say good morning to Shane Gordon. Good morning, Mr. Gordon.
G'day, Roy. How are you, buddy?
I have never been better in my life. Now, Shane has decided to join us this morning, not as an expert in any particular field, but also he's joining us to learn and contribute his own pennyweight worth of intellectual humour, wit and standard. We will be talking today about one of the most interesting and unusual murders and offenders in Sydney's history. This story overlaps with a whole number of topics that I'm going to be teaching Shane about. But also, I will be honest, the topic matter of this particular podcast is littered with political correctnesses that need to be observed. Now, I begin the ball rolling by saying that Mr. Gordon is how, if you don't mind me asking, Shane, how tall are you?
With shoes or without?
This probably sets the backdrop for the question.
I'm 5'6".
Right.
So 166 or 167 centimetres. Depends how hydrated I am.
So that puts you squarely in the middle of a range that people would say is neither tall nor tiny.
That's right.
Is that a political... how well did I do politically correctly saying that you're short?
Yeah, no, it wasn't bad. Like, I'm not offended. I understand where I'm at. I've lived this life for pretty much 40 years, so I get it.
Well, I am glad. I chose this particular piece with that in mind. So I knew you would get it because one of my best friends in the world is a man who I went to primary school with and have spent my life traveling alongside. And he is a man of short stature. He's a man called Matthew Woods. He was third place winner in all of New Zealand's Open Division bodybuilding. He's a bodybuilding champion. He's also the world heavyweight boxing champion for people with short stature division, otherwise known as dwarf division. He's a highly accomplished academic and a teacher, a school teacher. And Matt Woods is my best friend in the world, and he's also a high achiever in so many ways. So in part, I'm tipping my hat to my relationship with Matt as we talk about another man in this podcast who was born with short stature as well. But we will be using words that are designed to describe the nature of his difference, which is a form of dwarfism known as autodyspraxia, when we come to it. But there is we are paying all tribute and respect to the man that he was in this story. But this story begins, Shane, in Sydney in the 1920s. What's your knowledge of the 1920s like?
I know Don Bradman made his test debut in the 20s.
Right. And have you ever seen footage of the car he was driving in the 20s?
No.
It's worth a look on YouTube. And he did these ads in not speeding, you know, but he pulls up in this incredibly affluent 1930s Packard. And it's, he looked every bit as Al Capone-ish as Al Capone ever could. And so, so this story kind of, it culminates around then, but it starts a little bit earlier. I don't know if you know this, but there was a global economic crash in the 1890s, the early 1890s. Banks started folding. People were just, anybody that was poor was suddenly incredibly poor. Like Kenny from South Park poor in the 1890s. It was like nobody had really experienced that. And you're thinking, you know, lines of people lining up to get soup at the Salvation Army, that kind of thing. Right. Mm. So then more locally, do you know where Tamworth is? What do you think of when you think of Tamworth?
Country music.
That's right. These days you think country music, hey? But back in the day, Tamworth was the city of lights because it was the first city in the country to be equipped with what?
Electricity.
Electric lights on the streets. Full city.
Oh, really?
Yeah, Tamworth. So that's Tamworth in the date specific era, 1888. And that's the year when this chap is born. Now, his name is Robert Widgery. Kind of sounds like Witchetty Grub, doesn't it? But his name
Indigenous
is...
Indigenous man?
No, he's not. He's not. His dad is English. And his dad is a fascinating guy, born in the 1830s. And he comes to Australia after a failed marriage in England. And he's from Cornwall, which is Oxfordshire in England. And he comes to Australia and he gets a girl pregnant and then marries her 2 years later. Now, we think of the old days. We think, you know, very proper. You wouldn't ever get a girl pregnant. You certainly, if you did, you'd marry her straight away. But time and time again in the poorer classes, you see a very contemporary to now, that kind of people getting pregnant and then getting married or not. You know, you get a lot more of that than perhaps we're aware of. But he gets married and he ends up having Robert. But Robert's not the only child. They call him Bobby, is what he's more... his family calls him. But Bobby's born as a person of short stature and he's afflicted with dwarfism. Look, nowadays, I believe the community would offer every possible resource to somebody born with any kind of disability or difference. But back then, it was a really tough game, hey? Particularly in a country that placed so much emphasis on not just sport, but horse riding. So horses were the everything, right? They were the transport, but they were also like, I mean, we don't really have a modern day comparison. You can say cars, but it's so much more than that. They're workhorses, they're tools, they're even pets, but horses were everything, right?
You thought he would have made a good jockey then.
Well, you would have. Well, you know, horse riding isn't leg reliant. You do need it for a little bit of stability, but you don't really use your legs for a lot when you horse ride, if that makes sense.
I'm allergic, so I don't know.
Oh, you are? Are you allergic to the peanut butter they put inside Mr. Ed's mouth to make him talk? Or are you allergic?
No, it's the horse hair, but I am also allergic to peanut butter. Gives me terrible fluctuations.
So genuinely steer clear of kissing Mr. Ed on the lips. So Mr. Widgery, he's living in Tamworth and born there in 1888. He's born the same year as Squizzy Taylor. Kind of gives you a ballpark as to contemporary other ideas we have of Australian crime history. Now, Taylor was born in Victoria. This guy's born in Tamworth. But at the beginning of the century, so beginning of the First World War, really, the country swept with a pandemic. It was the influenza pandemic. Now, in this time of COVID and lockdowns and quarantines, we pretty quickly forget that it's not the first one. They called it the Spanish flu. But when it came, it killed, not you know, incapacitated, but killed 50 million people. And it's pretty big, isn't it? It's exceeds where we're at. I hope it continues to exceed where we're at with COVID.
It's probably only 60 million people on the planet then.
Look, it's I don't know. Yeah, look, I know Australia about that time had about 7 million. So there's your kind of ballpark. But what it did was it shut down theatres, travelling shows, anything where people met, and quarantines were regular. Okay, so it's not dissimilar now. And I actually showed this story to Knuckles very recently. I said, can you read this for me? And Knuckles is my other half. She read the story and she sent me a message with a screenshot where I had written, and this story appears in far more detail in my second book by the same title as this podcast, The Dawn of Crime. This is a story from that book. And the passage goes, in 1917, traveling along the eastern side of Australia, all shows, including circuses and theatres, were closed due to the Spanish flu outbreak. We own a theatre, in fact, two of them, and a wine bar that have all been closed down during COVID. And she wrote back and she said, man, I needed trigger warnings for this. It's very close to the bone. So in that mix, in Tamworth, at the time of those closures, there was a guy called Gus St. Leon. Now, Gus has a great grandson called Mark St. Leon. He's been on this show. Mark is an expert in Australian circus history. He's written a lot of books. But the St. Leon Circus was a very big one, and they were grounded. They were stuck in Tamworth. So where they'd normally come in, swoop in, you know, set up a show, then nick off, these guys were there for a prolonged period. It's probably there that he meets young Bobby Widgery. Okay, so this is the first, we hear a little bit about Bobby from family who I've been in touch with as I research this. He really comes to light when he strolls into the circus one day. He's also loved, this guy is loved in Tamworth as almost like a mascot. He's a public character that walks down the streets and he really kind of owns his difference.
Like Fonzie.
Like Fonzie. I mean, if they had a jukebox back then that he could bash, the Fonzie's office. Do you remember what Fonzie's office was?
It was a toilet.
He hung out in the men's toilets. He did.
Yeah, Fonzie's a creep.
He's a jukebox abusing, toilet hanging out creep.
He lived above a garage.
That's the epitome of success, isn't it? Living.
Yeah.
That's who
we all thought he was cool. No, he wasn't. He was a loser.
So there's a young Bobby Widgery strolling down the street in Tamworth, and the circus finally gets to ring out. Now, the story that hits the newspapers about him that night make out that he just kind of wandered in as a customer. Mark St. Leon and myself, we both suspect it was probably set up. If Gus St. Leon, the circus owner, was a circus owner who was worth his salts, he would have made it look organic, but would have set it up. Does that make sense?
Yes. Yes, it does.
So Bobby walks into the circus and at the end, they've got this crazy horse jumping around, kicking around. He's a bronco. He's out of control and they're holding him by the reins. And then he says, anybody can ride this horse will get a prize. And the audience over there on the side, they roar as somebody lowers Bobby into the ring. So this ordinarily, even if it was yourself, now this horse was it was 15 hands. It was maybe 6'8". It was a big beast, right? Even your good self. I've got to be honest, I'd watch you try and clamber onto this thing with great interest. I would. And I'd be yelling from the sidelines, your legs aren't important. I would. trying to coach you from the side. Yeah,
believe in yourself. You can do this.
I believe I can fly, but you know. And so Bobby's helped up onto the horse by the clowns in the act. And this also brings down the house kind of thing. Lo and behold, though, he's a really good rider. This guy has been riding horses all his life. He also personally takes a real interest in horses, and he's a very competent rider. So this thing starts galloping around the ring, and he's on it, and he's doing a great job. They had attached to him what's called a mechanic. It's kind of, you're thinking like in an abseiling harness, but more ropes than, you know, seatbelt kind of stuff. But it's around his chest, and it's got a hook at the back, and he's attached to a rope that goes up to the top of the center pole. So if he came undone at any point, he'd probably keep going in a circle until they caught him. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that's right.
But what they did was they yanked the rope up and sent him halfway up into the tent. So he's flying about 20 foot above the air.
Like a fine nun.
Right. And he's flying in a circle, arms and legs flailing madly. So this was the act. Then they bring him down and lower him onto the horse and he'd kind of ride it surfing. We call that Roman riding, where you're standing on its back like a surfboard.
Yeah.
So that was the act. And it was tremendously popular. But Bobby kind of brings himself apart about this time because he proves that he's also a bit of a drinker. He likes to drink. What do you like as a drunk, Shane?
I like a non-alcoholic beer.
You don't drink?
No, rarely. I get very annoying when I drink, so I just don't do it. I think that everyone came out to meet me, basically, when they did it.
I think I'm annoying until I drink. Then again, I think I'm annoying when I drink too. So, you know, it's a bit of a win and lose and lose. Yeah.
We've got some self-awareness, which is good.
It's healthy. But Widgery, he's a bitter drunk and a fighter too.
As little people can be when we drink.
Lots of accounts exist of his shape, not just his height, but he's very muscular. Like, he's got a lot of upper body strength. My mate, Matt, who measures in at, I think, 5'4", talks a lot about the mechanics of his legs. That as somebody with dwarfism, he has a lot more strength in his legs because of I explained it, I didn't really listen, but that's kind of how he describes it. Talk to me about your experience in cricket when you're running between wickets. How does it affect you?
Running between wickets? Well, I've only got little legs, so I run very hard. I do a lot of fitness work on the side, so running between wickets isn't an issue for me. I just got to take more steps than those longer.
I do feel you'd outrun me. I believe you'd outrun me.
100%.
My loping. That was too. You answered that with too much enthusiasm. That was.
We're going to keep it real between us, Roy.
Hurtful but real. So Widgery is a strong guy, and they head to South Australia with the circus, right? When they get there, I have to read between the lines a lot with this story, because what you get in research material is usually the sensationalized aspects of his physical build. Fact that he's working as a clown in a circus, you know, you kind of got to join dots somewhat. And I think he probably became a bit of a pain to work with. He was drunk more often than not. I was talking with a guy called he's the just passed away recently, is Mervyn Ashton. And Mervyn Ashton, his family are the Ashton Circus, and they're the longest continuously running English-speaking circus in the world, the Ashton Circus. And he was a lovely guy. His dad was very kind to me when I was younger. But I interviewed Mervyn as part of the story and asked him if he knew of Bobby Widgery. And he said, look, I didn't know him personally. He said, but things have changed so much that when he was a boy, it was only just a bit past this time. He said, if you had somebody with dwarfism on the show, it was a huge deal. People would come to see that. It was such a popular thing to have on a show. And I try to liken that to now. And I mean, would that be like a kid who has the latest edition of Minecraft? I mean, because my kids fight over that. I mean, is that, what would kids line up for? These are nothing yet. I can't line up anymore.
Yeah. To go outside for more than an hour?
Yeah, just to not be inside.
So, to not wear a mask.
Yeah. And he said, but if you had two people with dwarfism on your show, he said, you had a big show. So then there was another guy who wrote a book called The Silver Road, and it was a biography written by Mark St. Leon again, but it's a biography of Mervyn King, who ran big circuses, and he remembers Widgery. And his quote is, having more success than the normal people, Widgery was a huge and tremendous act. So he's remembered by a lot of people for being a really popular act. But by the time they get to Adelaide, it's from direct route from Bathurst down to the top of Victoria to Adelaide. They kick him out of the show.
Right. Yeah. So
it's not a long way, is it? It's not a very big journey, and they don't want him on the show anymore. So he heads back to Bathurst. And that's kind of when we start to see him appearing in police gazettes and coming afoul of the law a bit more. Right. Mm. He had some minor incursions with the law prior to this that I'm kind of glossing over, but he hit Sydney not long after this. And you kind of have to wonder whether what I'm about to describe, he developed in the circus when he was under a lot of, you go to a town, everybody's staring at you. You go out for drinks, everybody's staring at you, whether or not he just rolled with that. But he ends up kind of strolling into a pub every night. He'd go to three or four pubs with his mates, had three or four mates who were, normal height. Mm. They'd find one guy at the bar the room would stop and everybody'd stare, and he'd kind of do this boxing dance with his fists up and he'd hold back one guy at the bar as though they're holding his arms back. Widgery would kind of do this boxing thing without really hitting the guy, but pretending to box into the guy's chest, and everybody's laughing, and then they'd all take a bow, leave the pub in a hurry, and then the bloke realised that all his pockets had been picked while the mates were holding him back.
Yeah, nice.
Kind of the oldest trick in the book in some ways.
Yeah.
And so then I thought that's so mean that, like, there's probably a group of five guys, and they've seen this guy, Bobby, who's got dwarfism, and they thought, you know, we'll use him as a distraction and we'll use him essentially.
Mm.
But when you read the police gazettes, this is completely run by Widgery. He fires and hires guys, and at the end of the take, he gets them to pull out their pockets and he divides it up. He's the Fagin of, he's got a pickpocket game.
Yeah, nice.
So he's in control of his own misdoings, but he's not anybody schmuck.
Yeah, sounds like a little bit of network marketing almost.
It's a good pyramid scheme, if nothing else. I mean, it makes it look redundant now. I mean, I have people selling cosmetics that could learn from this. So this is what he gets, you know, stung with. And these are kind of those petty sessions crimes that keep coming up. I'll skirt past another one of his instances. He ends up back in court for assaulting a woman. And she says that she was an innocent bystander. He says that she was participating in some way, and it ends up in court. The judge says, I'm going to sentence you. At that time, they had, and we're talking the, you know, end of World War One, there was a police act which offered first-time offenders almost a get-jail-free warning, that they were trying to not institutionalize criminals. These days, there's an argument that it's such that it's traveled so far in that way that criminals get off over and over and over again. But back then, the kind of first time you're lucky, what do you call that in cricket? First ball, one bounce, one hand?
Yeah, let's go with that.
Yeah, so that's what it is in crime.
Yeah, okay.
So he gets out of jail on that one. Then he goes to something else, something quite petty. And the person drops the charge and he's twice gotten out. He's like Teflon, right?
Mm.
The family I've interviewed who survive, quite an elderly lady, she's his great nephew. And their family tradition says that his many siblings, they pulled together and they gathered their money and they secured him the lease on a newspaper stand near Central Station in Sydney. So this is an era where newspapers are king. And he did very well. He managed to, you know, marry, and he had a newspaper stand. But you know, you get these people, right? And they're kind of, they're just incorrigible. You can give them any amount of opportunities and they just can't keep away from being a crook.
Mm-hmm.
It just keeps, it keeps going back to these dodgy schemes, right? So his wife dies not long after they marry and he's pretty hard. And he starts hanging out with the seedy underbelly of Sydney again. And he's sighted with the Razor Gangs. Tilly Devine is at large. Snowy Cutmore is up in Sydney now. It's a pretty, you know, hell-raising place to be in the early 1920s. And he meets a guy at a bar. And, I take that back. He's living in a share house with a bunch of people. And one of the people is a 17-year-old girl. And she's at a bar on the 27th of December in 1924, and she meets a Syrian traveller called Abe Morloff. Now, Abe Morloff has in his possession 47 pounds. An average weekly wage is 2 pounds.
Ooh, he's loaded.
He is. He's like Don Bradman was when Don Bradman was playing cricket, but not like the cricket players were when Don Bradman took over cricket.
I gotcha. I'm with you.
So Don Bradman famously earned heaps, but then when he was put in charge of Cricket Australia, he screwed every player down for as much as he could. an interesting guy. Abe is at this bar. He sees this pretty 17-year-old girl, and she says, "Come back to where I'm staying." All right, he says. So heads off with this pretty girl in a foreign land. The age of consent was 14 at the time.
Oh, boy.
So while we say 17, she had been possibly doing this kind of thing for some time. So they go back to the place she's staying at, and in the lounge room is Bobby Widgery. He says, hello, you know, how are you doing? Bobby said, hey, you know, how about, you know, want me to get you a drink? Where do you think this is going?
Nowhere good.
Nowhere good, that's correct. Abe has a sip of the drink and doesn't remember a whole lot more.
Yeah, the old Mickey in the drink.
That's right, that's right.
As they called it, a Bobby back then.
A Bobby in the drink. He's taken a Bobby in the drink. So he comes to and he's now missing 47 pounds. And it's a lot of money, 47 pounds. He clearly has it for business that he's on and something he's going to buy or sell. But he's has no money. And he goes straight to the police. He says, look, this thing has happened to me. And I believe the police probably said, do you have a description of the guy?
Mm-hmm.
It wouldn't be a hard one to unpack at that point. So the cops grab him. He goes to court again. Lo and behold, he gets off. And it's two things happen with that. Either the bloke has dropped the case, and that could be because he's embarrassed about his intentions in the first place, or he drops it because he's a traveler and just doesn't pursue it. Or the third thing is that Widgery somehow has a connection at a legal level that manages to quash the case.
Mm-hmm.
He's three for three. He's like Teflon. You can't make it stick.
Right? What was his nickname? Slippery B or something like that?
He's doing real well for not going to jail. It's quite extraordinary. Mm-hmm. But with the death of his wife, right, he starts drinking heavily. And again, he's a very bitter drunk and he's a fighter. He's pretty capable. Like, there's instances where he's been in fights and we're able to remember them 100 plus years later, right? So it's pretty significant. He finds himself in a situation in the last days of his life where he's living in, I mean, share houses doesn't really cut it. You're looking at something that was probably built as a stable or, I don't know, a factory. It's like just walls with a window. And you get people will just doss down on literally Hessian sacks filled with straw that they call mattresses. This is not one or two people. There are so many rooms like this where you can buy cheap booze that's homemade. And this is that kind of fallout of the poverty that's around in the 1920s. And so Bobby finds himself in the last day of his life with a group of women. Are you familiar with Les Miserables?
I've heard of it. I haven't seen it though. No.
So this kind of, you'll see why I say this if you're familiar with Les Mis at home. There's a very famous scene where in the early parts of the story, there's a very good woman and she falls victim to the poverty in France at the time. And she sells her hair and her teeth that are pulled out of her head just to make a bit of money. It's a horrific.
Oh, what?
So just bear that in mind when I then tell you this next part of Bobby's story. He finds himself with these women and they're having a bender. They're drinking, you know, and they're having a great booze up in a place called Charles Lane in Woolloomooloo. Now, Woolloomooloo isn't a great place to be, particularly after dark. It's a rough place, you know, and they're laughing and he's their center of attention. He's in a room full of women. They're drinking out of flagons. A flagon is, it's two pints. So it's a big bottle, 1.1 liter.
Mm. Like McWilliam Sherry.
It is, that's exactly what you're thinking, right? And it's kind of swig, swig, pass. It's that kind of affair. And so they start in the late afternoon and then they run out of booze. They've got three bottles, it's gone. And the four of them start to sober up. And you know when that buzz kind of leaves you and you're still awake? Yeah, that's the fate that they face. So they go, you know what? We need to get more booze. None of us have a coin to our names. But then they realize that the three bottles they've just emptied probably have some value to the sly grog maker that they got them from. You see, they've got to provide their own bottles. So they used to buy them back. So they thought, well, let's go down and see if you'll swap us the three empty bottles for one full bottle of cheaply made booze that probably has rubbing alcohol in it. Right. So we're thinking Denko rub and water.
Yeah, delicious. Really put hairs on your chest. That's why people were tougher back then. That's what they lived on.
It's incredible stuff, isn't it? So they go to this fella, and he's a sly grog maker. His name is Kikoldi, and he's pretty well known, this guy. He's got bathtubs out the back with all kinds of things boiling away in them, you know. And he says, look, I don't need the bottles. I've got plenty at the moment. And so they leave, not quite knowing what to do or how to get it. And then one of the girls says, see this? And she pulls her hand out of her mouth and she's holding a wire strap with two teeth attached to it. They're a falsity, right? She goes, if I take these back to the dentist, he'll pay me half as much as I pay for them. And then we can get more booze.
That's dedicated to the drink, isn't it?
I've got to be honest. I've made some life decisions that I've not been proud of in my life.
Mm.
I've made some mistakes that I've been proud of because of how I handled them. I dare say if you're out on the town and you find yourself selling your teeth, you may be in over your head.
Yeah.
One takeaway from
this. One of the last things I'd sell for a drink.
I mean, when I was reading this research, cool that this talks about, builds up to this. I think the author in this newspaper article was deliberate because he made me think she was going to sell something else.
Yeah. That's what I was thinking as well when you said pulls out. And I'm like, oh, well, here we go. Ding dong. Yeah.
And no. So in Les Mis, there is a line where this poor girl, she sold her teeth because she wanted to keep her virtue. And then she finds herself selling her virtue, but she's missing her front teeth, and somebody says you sold them in the wrong order. So this kind of has that Les Mis heart to it, right? So then the events that unfold pretty quickly thereafter. They end up heading down, you know, they're still in that Woolloomooloo area, and it's hard to know whether Kikoldi is the same guy who is the sly grog merchant that they went to earlier or not. But Kikoldi is, he finds himself in Woolloomooloo and the group kind of descend on him. He's got his own sly grog shop and it's not clear as to whether it's the one they went to earlier or it's the same one. But very quickly, in the matter of seconds, a very drunk Widgery who's been drinking booze off the back of the sold teeth, he encounters Kikoldi and a fight breaks out and the girls are all screaming in a laneway, as you can probably, you know, imagine that scene.
Mm-hmm.
And then Kikoldi runs and Bobby falls to the floor. There's a witness account of somebody who's watching from a first floor window into the laneway. But the women are trying to gather him up, trying to get him on his feet, and it's useless. He's immobile, but he's alive.
But is it because he's drunk or because he's been had the shit beaten out of him?
The latter, because he's now bleeding profusely.
Roger.
And as they think he's just been hit, because nobody really saw a weapon. And this stands in Kikoldi's favor. He wasn't brandishing a knife as though I'm going to stab you. And there's some premeditation in even standing there with a knife ready to face someone while they come towards you.
Mm.
Nobody saw the knife. But when they get into hospital, he's got an incision behind his left ear on a downward angle that almost hits his spine. So it's a really solid stab in the back of the neck and he bleeds to death. So Kikoldi is rounded up and he pleads guilty to the charge, but he pleads that it was self-defense because to all accounts, the women and the person in the window, they said that Bobby Widgery had not just started doing his funny little boxing sketch, but he also pushed the guy, punched the guy, and got him on the ground at one point. So he was really into this guy. And I guess there's a point where the guy goes, you know, I can take you, probably knock it off, mate. Hey, this is getting serious.
Mm-hmm.
Panics, and he stabs him. Now, there's no follow-up. I can't find any follow-up case notes for a major trial, and he certainly doesn't end up in jail. So Kirkcaldy, who kills Bobby Widgery, ends up going back to sea as a sailor. And it kind of, it's almost like a fading out of a non-grand ending to a pretty incredible story. And I thought that can't be all there is to it, that Bobby's killed, you know, and this guy just nicks off. But there was more. The family came together and they put a headstone together for Bobby in Sydney. And Kirkcaldy went out to sea and he stayed as a sailor. But in the middle of World War II, 1941, he himself got drunk and he fell down the open hatch of a boiler room on the ship he was serving, landing face first and breaking his neck, and he died. So that was the end of the man who killed Bobby Widgery. And it kind of has, this story has no winners, does it?
No, absolutely not.
It's one of the most fascinating stories I've ever read. But I think as we kind of come to its conclusion, I think some of the takeaways that I have are, if you're going to kill a well-known circus performer of short stature who has a fighting and drinking habit, cautiously, don't do it if they've just sold teeth. Also, probably stay away from ships. And I'm trying to think of any other takeaways from this fascinating story. Don't drink things given to you by Bobby Widgery.
And be wary of a person of short stature hanging around multiple men.
This also,
in a bar.
This also, don't have your arms held back at any point in time.
Yeah.
So this story has been brought to you by the letter B for Bobby. I've been joined by my good friend and stand-up comedian, Shane Gordon. This story has been a direct extract from the second volume of the book series, The Dawn of Crime, which you can find on the internet by Googling The Dawn of Crime and Roy Malloy. Otherwise, head over to Facebook and add me on my Roy Malloy author page. And thank you so much for joining me, Mr. Shane Gordon.
Thank you, Roy.